Council and State versus Donnie Harrell, could please step up. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Annette Verdesco from the law firm of Caruso Smith Pacini on behalf of the appellant, defendant Donnie Harrell.
Claude Heffron from Pashman Stein Walter Hayden on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Assistant Prosecutor Milton S. Leibowitz on behalf of the state.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Verdesco, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the Honorable Court? Good morning, Justices. The issue before this court today is whether the appellant Donnie Harrell's rights under the Confrontation Clause will be violated by the admission of AR's tender year statement into evidence when she did not recall some of the substantive allegations she made in the videotape evidence against the defendant at a 104 hearing. The companion issue in this case, Judge, is whether the appellate division committed error in overruling the trial court's order directive, which ordered the redaction of AR's videotape statement to only include the allegations that she recalled. At the time of the incident, AR was 8 years old. She was in second grade at Plainfield Municipal District. The defendant was her teacher, her music teacher. At the time in March of 2016, AR made some allegations against the defendant. The first allegation she made, which I'm going to label the under the table incident, AR alleged that the defendant took her hand and put it on his penis over her clothing. The under the table incident is not an issue before this court because she recalled that incident at the 104 hearing. The allegations that AR did not recall is that the defendant touched her private parts, namely her buttocks, her thigh, and her vaginal area over her clothing, and that he rubbed his penis against her. Those allegations she had no recollection of at the 104 hearing. She made all allegations in the videotaped interview shortly after the incident. That videotaped interview was heard by the court at a pretrial hearing in this case, in which the court admitted her statements made in that interview pursuant to the tender years exception under the rules of evidence. However, shortly before this case proceeded to trial, the state informed the defense that AR was unable to recall some of the incidents that she alleged in the video interview.
Counsel, just in case it helps you, we're familiar with the facts. You can go forward to your argument.
All right. Thank you, Judge. The undisputed record that I think is relevant before this court is AR testified at the hearing. She only testified to certain germane, innocuous facts as to the layout of the courtroom. Defendant was her music teacher. She testified to the under the table incident. She could not recall even the touching incident, inappropriate touching incident ever occurring. She could not recall telling the police about it. She had no recollection whatsoever of the incident. She did remember telling the police something, but had no recollection as to the substantive or material facts. It is undisputed that her statement is testimonial, that thereby it would trigger the confrontation clause, because her statement was anticipated, taken in anticipation of criminal prosecution in this case. There's also a strong argument to be made that these allegations that are subject to the appeal are solely based in evidence in the video statement that AR gave. Before we get to the confrontation issue, I submit to these honorable judges that we first must decide whether AR is even available for testimony under the evidence rules. And that issue was set forth in my brief. We specifically set forth that she's unavailable under evidence rule 804A4, which requires And sets forth a declarant is unavailable when she has a lack of memory or statement. That rule was cited in a Supreme Court case, State versus Coder, which is similar to this case as well, 198 New Jersey 451 2009, which is still good law. In State versus Coder, a three-year-old child was taken in the basement, allegedly sexually assaulted, and she had no recollection of the events at the 104 hearing and could not testify at trial as well. This court set forth that the three-year-old victim's inability or unwillingness to testify made her unavailable under New Jersey Rule of Evidence 804A3. Ultimately, this court allowed the statement in because it was non-testimonial and did not trigger the Confrontation Clause. We also cited to Evidence Rule 602, which the victim or the witness must have personal knowledge to testify. I respectfully submit to this court in this case, AR is unavailable to testify. The tender years exception, 803C27, requires the victim to be available to testify. Her lack of memory, her total lack of memory, as it relates to these allegations that are an issue before this court, makes her unavailable.
Why would it matter whether she was unavailable under Rule 804 if the rule that the state is relying on is Rule 803C, which explicitly concerns statements that do not depend on declarant's availability? And then 803C27C... I think is specifically just asking if the child testifies at the proceeding here, she would testify at trial, correct?
That's correct, Judge.
So how do we even get to 804A3 if the state is relying on 803, which specifically doesn't depend on availability and asks only whether the child will testify at trial?
Well, Judge, there's a question, I think, in cases when the child cannot testify in trial.
But here she can.
Why
are we relying on cases where I understand in Coder that the child did not testify at trial. So that seems like a significant difference because here the rule simply asks, will the child, quote, testify at the proceeding? And here the answer is yes. And in Coder it was no.
That's correct, Judge. But I think the question becomes, she's physically able to be present at the hearing, but can she really testify as to the allegations in issue?
Counsel, isn't that your constitutional argument?
Excuse me, Judge?
Isn't that really your constitutional?
That's correct, Judge.
So let's
And I will move on to that.
Put 804 in the back.
I will, Your Honor. So the question then becomes whether confrontation is violated by the admission of the victim's statement into evidence in this case. Obviously, the seminal case is Crawford versus Washington, and that case sets forth pretty much that reliability of the witness has to be assessed by way of cross-examination.
So you're going to cross-examine her, and I presume you'll do a very skillful job. And you will, I'm sure, be able to establish before the jury that the three out of the four allegations that she made at the time of the investigation, she has no recollection of and doesn't even recall making the statement. And that's cross-examination, isn't it, counsel?
Your Honor, I submit to this court that is not cross-examination as required by the Confrontation Clause.
Why is that not? That goes to her credibility, that discounts you've conceded that she will be able to testify with respect to the so-called table incident, so presumably a jury would be able to compare her testimony, which she remembers the statement, she remembers the event, she can testify to it. You'll obviously have cross about it, but to three other incidents, part of the charges here, in which her recollection does not exist, apparently. So why is that not cross-examination?
Because it's not meaningful and effective cross-examination. It's only the opportunity to cross-examine. And I submit that's what this court has to decide today.
So are you saying that the Confrontation Clause requires effective cross-examination? Because I respectfully suggest that's not what it requires.
Your Honor, I do submit that to this court. I submit that this just your justices today have to decide what is required under the Confrontation Clause. Is it mere opportunity to cross-examine with the witness just being physically present on the stand? Or does it require meaningful and effective cross-examination?
Well, anytime that cross-examination is not effective in the defendant's view, perhaps because the witness remembers 9 events but is shaky on the 10th, that there's a confrontation violation of the statement?
No, Your Honor. No, you're not. It's in this circumstance where you're going to have, if that entire video statement is admitted into evidence, what's going to happen is this victim's going to come on the stand. She's going to testify to the germane, undisputed facts of the classroom. She's going to testify to the under-the-table incident. And as it relates to the allegations in issue, she cannot respond.
So the opinion the court will write in this case will have an impact in other cases, of course, as well.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what I want you to do is try to help us understand the breadth of your argument, its scope. Where is the constitutional line in terms of when a witness with a failure to recollect can testify? So you've argued to us that if they cannot, they have no memory, they shouldn't be allowed on the stand. If they have a faulty memory as to important key facts, can they testify? If they have a weak memory as to some but not all of the key facts, can they testify? Where does the Constitution draw the line?
I believe the line is drawn when there is no memory. This is not a witness that has a bad memory or a faulty memory whose memory can be tested on cross-examination. I believe the line is drawn in circumstances where the victim or the witness has no memory whatsoever.
So you're drawing, to borrow from your argument, you see a distinction between an empty vessel and a nearly empty vessel. One can testify, but the other can't.
A nearly empty vessel can recount some of the facts that surround the allegations. And that's really what the issue is here. The defense is unable to challenge these allegations that form the basis of the charges against the defendant, that form the basis of the elements of the crime against defendant, which the state has the burden to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
You say that you have the inability to challenge, but you could ask the victim on the stand, in fact, you do not remember anything about this allegation, correct?
That's correct.
And you could point out, for example, as you explained, that the victim remembered the layout of the room and I think also remembered something that had moved in the room when she was shown a picture of it. And you could explain that the victim remembered talking to a friend. I think she even said she had talked to 2 friends about incidents of sexual assault. You could point all of this out and then point out, and you remember absolutely nothing about this incident, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why is that not an opportunity for cross-examination?
It's not an opportunity to cross-examine because she cannot be tested as to her perception and her recollection of these events that form the charges against the defendant. She cannot be questioned as to the where, how, and why of these allegations, which is the basis of cross-examination to discover the truth.
Respectfully, it looks to me like a particularly valuable opportunity for cross-examination because you're not going to be quibbling over the details on these events. She is going to testify, and I think the 104 hearing establishes what she'll testify, but she has no recollection of either those incidents occurring or or telling the detective that those incidents had occurred. So to say that it's not that there isn't an opportunity to go over the specifics, to me would suggest that you have the opportunity for a particularly strong cross-examination on those issues.
The concern is, what about the prejudice to the defendant that these unsubstantiated allegations come into evidence, they're not tested, they're not challenged on cross-examination as to the specifics because she has no memory. What is the cumulative effect to that? Does that cause the jury to then speculate? Does that then cause that this victim's credibility is bolstered because the fact finder may interpret, well, she remembers the under the table incident. Why doesn't she recall these other allegations?
Having had the chance to cross and discuss those matter in court with the witness present, doesn't it give both parties the opportunity at closing to make suggestions about it? You know, if she lied about three of them because they didn't happen, then the fourth one didn't happen. The state gets to do the opposite. I mean, doesn't everybody get a fair shot to evaluate that evidence based on the lack of memory and use it to their particular advantage?
I believe they get a fair shot, but the prejudice to the defendant cannot be overcome. Because as I said, the jury could be caused to speculate as to the allegation, why she doesn't remember those, why she remembers the under the table. Well, she remembers the under the table, that could bolster her credibility. And here, the
you're conceding that comes in. Right. You're conceding that comes in. So under all scenarios, she testifies about that event and her statement comes in on that event, right?
Under the table, yes.
So are you suggesting that by having her on the stand admitting she has no recollection of these other events, she is somehow bolstering her testimony and bolstering her credibility when she doesn't remember these other events?
I submit that the state is. By admission of these allegations, the state's case is bolstered, and possibly the victim's credibility is bolstered.
But the credibility determination is made by the jury after what, again, I'm sure would be a cross-examination pointing out every single reason why the jury should not find her testimony credible or find the video credible because of her lack of memory and what occurred in those other instances. That's a fact for the jury.
That is correct. But the difference is, with a normal witness, you're able to test memory.
A normal witness can say, I don't remember.
That's correct, but not to...
I don't remember to a dozen questions.
But respectfully, not to all the allegations.
Why not? So in this court's holding in Sims, I thought that what happened there was that at the Wade Henderson hearing, PB testified that he recalled absolutely nothing about the shooting or the statement made to the police. And this court still said successful cross-examination is not the constitutional guarantee. Instead, the confrontation clause guarantees an opportunity for effective cross-examination, not cross-examination that's effective in whatever way, to whatever extent the defendant might wish. So here the person says, I don't recall, I don't remember, I don't recall, I don't remember, I remember nothing. And this court still says, no confrontation clause violation, no problem.
But I believe in Sims, the witness there had a feigned memory. So there was some basis of cross-examination, Your Honor, because at one point he made one statement and then at trial says, or at the Wade hearing says he couldn't recall, did not recall. That dealt with a feigned memory. It did not deal with a witness with no memory.
He said he had no memory. You're saying that the court found that that was fake.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And
yes.
So you're saying that if someone testifies that they have no memory, if the court finds that it's fake, then it's fine. But if the court finds that it's not fake, then it's never okay. And their prior statements cannot come in, even if they do have a memory of certain incidents.
I say when you're dealing with someone that feigns memory, you still have an ability to cross-examine that person. Because you could say you made this statement. Now you changed your position. It's like an inconsistent statement. With a witness with no memory, you can't impeach her. You can't impeach any kind of inconsistency or consistency about the facts.
Well, going back to Sims, in Sims, we noted the case in United States v. Owens, where the U.S. Supreme Court stated that the Confrontation Clause provides no guarantee that every witness called by the prosecution will refrain from giving testimony that is marred by forgetfulness, confusion, or evasion, but rather is generally satisfied when the defense is given a full and fair opportunity to probe and expose those infirmities through cross-examination. Sounds like your argument is completely counter to that statement.
Well, Owens...
Because we're talking about forgetfulness, confusion, evasion, a variety of reasons why a witness might not be answering a question on cross-examination as wonderfully as the defense counsel would like.
Owens, once again, is different than this scenario, because Owens was an identification case. And if I recall correctly, the witness was able to recall that the identification, their current beliefs, but could not recall how they arrived at that identification. Also, the witness was able to testify as to the basis of and the facts regarding the attack against him.
No, I think he acknowledged that he didn't recall seeing the attacker and that he couldn't recall any discussions he had while hospitalized. I think that's what happened in the second statement. So I'm still, it seems like you're trying to draw very, very, very fine distinctions. And I think the Chief Justice had asked, what is the constitutional basis for the rule? And you said, if the person cannot remember at all. But here we said, we discussed already how the victim can remember certain incidents. So where is the constitutional line?
The constitutional line has to be where cross-examination is not fruitless or futile, especially when you're dealing with specific allegations against the defendant that form the basis of the crimes charged against him. There's no way to challenge AR as to her prior statement because she has no memory, no recollection. You can't question her and you can't impeach her. You can't question her about bias.
Sure you can. She's sitting in the courtroom, and she is telling the jury, I don't remember this whole thing. And she was a child. She's obviously not very old now, but she was a child at the time. And the jury can make a lot of different assessments, and one of those is, somebody suggested this to this child. This really didn't happen. She remembers the one incident, but she doesn't remember these other incidents. And there's a real question, considering the state's burden to prove each allegation by beyond a reasonable doubt, as to whether those allegations can be sustained in light of that. So why is that not cross-examination that could be, may not be, never know what juries are thinking, but it could be extremely effective, as I'm sure you could make it.
But how do we reconcile that with the appellate division decision in Nyhammer that had strikingly similar facts to the case before this honorable court? And I submit...
The attorney didn't cross-examine in Nyhammer.
Yeah.
That's correct. There was no cross-examination. But and that's why the case was not overruled by this court, because this court ruled that the defendant waived his opportunity to confrontation.
So how then does Nyhammer help you?
Nyhammer helps me because my position is the appellate division case is still good law.
And even though it was not adopted by the Supreme Court?
My position is the Supreme Court did not overrule Nyhammer. In their opinion, because you never got to the issue. You never got to the issue as to what was required under the confrontation clause when you're dealing with a silent and unresponsive witness.
Court affirm or reverse the judgment of the appellate division?
Reversed.
And it held that there was no confrontation clause violation, correct?
That's correct, because the defendant waived his right to confrontation.
The court never actually said that the defendant waived any right, though, correct?
I believe the court did. I believe the court did. That's why he never got to the issue as to what was required under the confrontation clause.
But as described by the appellate division, the child in that case was an largely unresponsive witness.
That's correct.
She's not saying, I don't remember this. She's not answering questions, right? She was... She, at least as described by the appellate division.
As described by the appellate division, the victim was unresponsive. But isn't AR unresponsive to the allegations at issue?
AR is testifying as to all of these allegations. In the table case, she's going to testify as to the allegation and her recollection of the allegation. And in the other three instances... she is going, presumably, if she testifies consistently with her 104 testimony, she's going to say, I don't remember it. I don't remember that event. That's testimony.
And I think that's specifically covered by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Owens, where they specifically said a witness is regarded as subject to cross-examination when that witness is placed on the stand under oath and responds willingly to questions. So even if we said in Nyhammer that maybe it would have been a different case because there the child did not respond willingly to questions and just shook her head no, here everyone
concedes that the witness will respond willingly to questions, correct? Perhaps not in the way that you would like her to respond, but she will be responding to questions. She will not simply be shaking her head no or remaining utterly silent.
The issue, I believe, Your Honors, that still exists, though, is it mere opportunity to cross-examination as required under the Confrontation Clause, or is it meaningful cross-examination? If cross-examination is going to be fruitless or futile, how is a fundamental right, a Sixth Amendment right, a right that's guaranteed by the federal Constitution and the New Jersey Constitution satisfied? How is it satisfied?
Because she's going to say, presumably she's going to say to you at that moment with the jury watching, I don't remember that.
And you could even go further than that. And as to each recollection that she fails to have, you can ask the question, are you making this up? And you'll get an answer. So where is the denial of an opportunity to fully have every question answered and get an answer to it?
Because it appears that your honorable justices are suggesting that it goes to credibility as opposed to admissibility. The problem with this issue going to credibility is there's no opportunity to impeach her as to these allegations.
You're not entitled under the Constitution to impeach witnesses. You're simply entitled to a fair cross-examination.
But isn't that what cross-examination is, impeaching credibility?
Not simply.
Counsel, if you're correct, what's left of the hearsay exception for recorded recollection, 803C5? How does that pass constitutional muster?
Number one, Your Honors, I submit respectfully that no evidence rule should take prevalence or relevance over a constitutional fundamental right. That shouldn't be part of the analysis.
You're correct. So is 803C5 unconstitutional?
No. 803C5, which is present recollection, right?
Recorded recollection.
Right. I don't know how that is relevant to the analysis, because isn't that rule dealing with refreshing recollection?
So imagine this situation. A witness testifies in court and has an insufficient present recollection about the key allegation. They say, I can't remember. The rule permits a prior statement to be introduced under certain circumstances.
That's correct.
How does that square with your argument? Could that happen if we rule in your favor?
Yes. And I'm going to tell you why, because AR was shown her video statement. She was shown her videotape record statement prior to trial, and she still could not recall.
Assume the same thing happened in the hypothetical.
Because there would be an ability to refresh recollection. That's what the exception is for. Here, her recollection could not be refreshed. That's the issue.
This is about recorded recollection.
It's not refreshed recollection. It's past recollection recorded, where the statement itself is not, the written statement is not introduced into evidence, but it's read to the jury after the prerequisites are established under the court rule that the chief just mentioned. It's not refreshing someone's recollection. It's admitting statements under the past recollection recorded exception to the hearsay rule. So to the chief's question, if we go along with what you're saying, what does that leave to the past recollection recorded exception to the hearsay rule, as the state pointed out in its supplemental brief?
Well, I don't know that that rule applies in situations when you're dealing with a tender years exception. Here, it's the tender years exception. Okay.
So what? It's a past recollection recorded that comes in under certain standards and criteria, and you're arguing that that's a violation of the Confrontation Clause, even though the cases say it's not, since the person's present and can be cross-examined.
If the witness has, it depends upon what's contained in the statement. Chief Justice, it was your hypothetical that it's a victim's recorded statement, as in this situation, that go to the substantive charges against the defendant.
Yes. I think your argument might have to be, look, the tender years exception is unconstitutional under this scenario that's being presented, and the same is true for the other hearsay exception for recorded recollection. I don't know how you slice the two, and that's why I'm asking.
Well, as I previously stated, I don't know that an evidence rule can survive or have more relevance beyond the constitutional right, especially a right to confrontation that goes to the core of the adversarial process.
Does that mean you believe that the recorded recollection exception in certain circumstances would likewise be unconstitutional?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You have cases supporting that?
No, I don't. Not before this court today. I don't.
Even in other jurisdictions brought under the federal constitution?
No, I do not, Your Honor. May I continue?
Of course.
In conclusion, I submit to this court that the appellate division's analysis and rationale was flawed in the reliance upon certain cases, as we discussed and distinguished during Your Honor's question to me, and that the confrontation clause requires more than a witness's mere presence on the stand or an opportunity to cross-examination. It requires, and especially when you're dealing with material facts that go to the basis of the charges of the defendant, it requires meaningful and sufficient cross-examination. In this case, AR cannot be challenged.
What is sufficient cross-examination? Does that mean successful cross-examination?
No. No, it means the ability to cross based upon the perception of the events. It means the ability to cross and maybe trying to show that the allegations were suggested by others. It means maybe being able to try and show bias, lack of attention, undue haste in recounting events, inconsistent testimony. That is what I'm suggesting is meaningful cross-examination, not a witness just being physically present on the stand. AR will be physically present, but she's not going to be mentally present as it relates to these allegations. So I respectfully submit.
She will testify about those allegations.
And her answer is going to be, I don't know.
There are witnesses out there who will won't respond. They will just not acknowledge the question. She's going to answer, presumably, every single question as she did in the 104 hearing.
I understand that, Your Honors. But I'm saying that's still not enough. And for all those reasons, I respectfully request Your Honors to reverse the appellate division decision and reaffirm the trial court that directs the redaction of the AR's video statement to only the allegations she can recall.
Thank you, Ms. Podesta.
I thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Heffron.
May it please the court. Mr. Harrell is entitled to a trial in which only admissible evidence is presented, and a trial in which he is able to effectively cross-examine the principal witness against him as to the core accusations in the case. Because of the 33-month delay in charging Mr. Harrell, compounded by the fact that all four incidents are charged collectively as two different counts of the indictment, at the time of trial, AR is not able to recount three out of the four incidents alleged against Mr. Harrell. The trial court's decision to redact references to the three forgotten incidents is the only way to ensure compliance with the rules of evidence as well as with the confrontation clause. And for that reason, we are asking that the court reverse the decision of the appellate division and restore the well-reasoned decision of the trial court. Like my colleague, I'm going to attempt to discuss briefly first the evidentiary rules and then move on to the confrontation clause issues, subject to this court's questions, of course. But starting with the rule under the tender years exception, I do want to take a slightly different position, which is that the tender years exception, 803C27 subsection C, requires that AR be present and testify. And I would submit that testifying is not just being in a chair. It's not answering questions about the layout of the room. It is presenting evidence as to the core accusations in the case. And I say that in reliance on dictionary definitions of the word testify, which refer to it, in fact, as presenting evidence.
If she says, I don't remember that, that's not testimony.
That's our position.
You're saying that's not testimony.
I would submit that it's, one, it's not testimony, and two, it's unlikely to be responsive to a question that would be asked on cross-examination.
Well, the counsel will presumably ask her about, you know, leading questions with respect to those incidents, and she presumably will say, I don't remember, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Right.
That's not testimony?
Testimony is presenting evidence on the core allegations.
So when a witness is asked about 10 different incidents and one of them says, I'm sorry, that one I don't remember, that doesn't count as testimony?
We would submit that it's not testimony in the way that the rule requires. And I would note that the rule specifically requires testimony, knowing, of course, that we also have the confrontation clause. And I would submit that 803C27, in fact, sort of imposes like a confrontation plus kind of analysis, because it's not just requiring presence, but it's requiring testimony.
Let's focus. I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
So if a witness is testifying and answering hundreds of questions while on the stand, we are to parse through every single answer where that witness says, I do not recall, and toss it aside. That's not testimony. I'm trying to understand practically, what does that mean? Because I think we would all agree during the course of a trial, witnesses will respond, I don't recall, I don't remember. So what practically does this mean for a witness testifying who is answering hundreds, if not thousands, of questions?
So the distinction I'm making is really focusing on these core accusations, because that is the language that this court used in State versus Nyhammer. And it specifically said that had counsel confronted Amanda on her claims on cross-examination and had she remained silent or unresponsive, then we would have on the record whether her silence or unresponsiveness denied defendant his constitutional right of confrontation. And the court focused.
The word unresponsive didn't mean that the defense attorney didn't think that her answer was responsive to what he had asked. It meant that she sat and did not say anything. She did not speak. She just shook her head no. From here, in the Rule 104 testimony here, the AR was in no way unresponsive. She responded to every single question, and she was in no way silent. She responded to every single question. So I'm just not sure how Nyhammer, even that statement from the court, you know, there could be an issue if a witness is completely unresponsive and completely silent. How does that help you?
So I think that helps insofar as, and I understand the distinction you're drawing between unresponsive in the colloquial sense of not answering the question versus unresponsive to a leading question that usually requires a yes or no answer, right? I understand that that's a distinction. However, in Nyhammer, I think that brings us, in fact, a little bit to Coder, because in Coder, the child was also answering questions. She just did not have the answers insofar as she didn't recall the information. But it wasn't that she was silent. She did. She came in. She gave testimony.
She didn't testify at trial, correct? Her mother
she did not
testify
at trial.
On her behalf.
She testified at the tender years hearing. And at the tender years hearing, she was considered, even though she gave answers yes and no, that she did not recall, she was considered unresponsive in that context the questions because she wasn't able to speak about the accusations in the case.
Will you go back to Nyhammer for just a moment? Because the language that you quoted, I think bears careful attention. It's, had she remained completely silent or unresponsive, then we would have a record on which to decide whether she was denied the constitutional right to confrontation. Do you take that to mean that the court would have ruled a particular way? The plain language seems to suggest the court hadn't decided.
I agree with your interpretation, Your Honor. I think it left it open.
And here we are.
Here we are. That's why we're here.
Here we are.
And I think it left it open. And this is why, you know, I can say that I'm starting with the rules of evidence, but here we are going into the confrontation clause because it's all, in fact, rather intertwined. And I think the reason that it's so intertwined is because our case law has never said under the confrontation clause, you have a per se denial of the right to confront someone when they forget. But we've also never said you have a per se protection. You are per se, your confrontation rights are being protected either. So it is
Sorry,
always-
What did you mean a per se denial?
So when somebody, as in Owens or Fenster, gets up and says, I don't recall, that doesn't mean per se, in every case where someone doesn't recall, that the defendant's right to confront the witnesses has been eviscerated.
Well, in Owens, the court found that the defendant's confrontation rights were protected.
I agree. But Owens didn't lead to the conclusion that the converse, which is that every time a witness says, I don't remember, that is constitutional under the confrontation clause.
Not sure if that's true, because Owens does specifically say a witness is regarded as subject to cross-examination when that witness is placed on the stand under oath and responds willingly to questions. Here, it seems like there is no question that AR would respond willingly to questions. Again, it might not be the response that you would prefer it to be, but I think everyone acknowledges that AR will respond willingly to questions, and that is the test in Owens.
I don't think she would respond in the sense of being responsive to leading questions. He touched your buttocks. I don't remember. I would consider that non-responsive.
But again, there's nothing in Owens that indicates that, because in Owens he said, I don't remember, and it was still that he was subject to cross-examination because he was placed on the stand and responded willingly to questions.
Well, Owens requires that you be subjected to effective cross-examination, and different terms
sorry,
are used.
What did you say?
I'm sorry. Owens requires that a witness be subjected to effective cross-examination. That's the qualifier used in that case. We have
only
other cases.
Only an opportunity for effective cross-examination, right?
An opportunity for effective cross-examination. There are other cases that use the word adequate, full and meaningful, I believe, is the Douglas v. Alabama term, right? So there's always some sort of qualifier in front of cross-examination. And I say that, and I think we need to go to Owens, we need to probe a little bit deeper, because in Owens, there's a massive reliance on Fenster, which is an extremely fact-specific situation. In Fenster, when you have a witness who is an expert testifying, but they don't recall the basis for the conclusion that they made, the court deems it, I think the word they use is self-impeaching, right? That is a far cry from a lay witness who can't remember the basis for
why isn't
conclusion.
That tremendously impeaching, not necessarily of her honesty or veracity, but it is potentially extremely effective cross-examination to ask her, do you remember, and fill in the facts, and she said I don't remember, in front of the jury saying I do not remember that is why isn't that tremendously impeaching with respect to to her ability to sustain the case, the state's charges in that instance.
It's not effective in the constitutional sense, I would submit, because and I would draw the court's attention to the dissent in Owens. And I realize it's a dissent. However, I think it's important to look at, because what the dissent really highlights there, Justice Brennan points to the fact that Fenster is a very self-contained fact-specific case, and that the court had never held before that a mere opportunity to pose questions, and this is a quote, we have never until today equated effectiveness with the mere opportunity to pose questions. The touchstone of effectiveness is whether the cross-examination affords the trier of fact a satisfactory basis for evaluating the truth of the prior statement. And what we're going to have here is a videotaped statement of a young, innocent 8-year-old child, uncontested. Yes, she doesn't remember it now, but you can't probe why that statement, which was taken under optimal circumstances to the state, where they got to have the child maybe meet the person before he walked into the room. He warms her up. He talks to her about her family, right? He gets her comfortable. And that's fine. They're allowed to do that. I'm not saying it's bad interview techniques, but what I'm saying is when the state gets to ask a witness questions under optimal circumstances.
Are you suggesting the court should not follow Owens?
I'm suggesting that Owens requires effective cross-examination and that that is not what can be done here. And in Owens, there were numerous...
Defined it as willingly responding to questions.
Well, it also, and on the facts of Owens, it found that the person, there are areas of cross-examination that are much more robust than what we have here because we have the previous identification. We have references in the medical records. I think on the facts of Owens, there are other areas of cross-examination that are fruitful.
And here we have one incident that she says she remembers. And she can be thoroughly cross-examined on as to whether someone suggested that to her, as to her inconsistency among the different statements that she made. She can be crossed in a way that suggests that not necessarily that she was lying, but that the situation was overwhelming with adults suggesting something happened to her. And her testimony can be significantly undermined through that process.
I think the converse is also true, which is, I think, what my colleague was alluding to, which is that the testimony can be significantly bolstered because what this jury is going to see is a videotape, and we know videotape is extremely powerful. You're going to see the image of the child telling the story. You know, by the time this returns to trial, it'll probably be at least 8 years ago. And then you're going to see the child coming in today. And a trial court has already found that the present testimony that this child does not remember the incident is credible. So I think what you're going to have effectively is a jury saying, well, I don't have anything to compare the prior statement to, but she made the prior statement and she's a credible witness today. So that must mean she was credible then. And even as to these other three allegations, all contained within the same count of the indictment, but they're sort of effectively functioning at this point like 404B. The state isn't really pursuing them in present time in the sense that she can't give testimony on the stand today about three of the incidents. So they're going, I think there's a concern that the jury's going to make the conclusion.
I'm sorry, I thought they were pursuing all four charges.
They are, but I'm saying it's akin to that because their pursuit, you know, they're all in one count.
But in 404B, that's uncharged bad acts. This is charged bad acts.
It's charged, but it's effectively not corroborated, right? What you have is four acts, all charged as two different offenses. And they're charged collectively. And what that does here is it gives the state the opportunity to say, well, this is, you don't get a witness who remembers everything. There may be witnesses who forget some things, but it's not just some things. It's not just, was Mr. Harrell's classroom next to Mr. Smith's? It's, did three of these incidents happen?
And that's all going to be before the jury. That is those very points I would expect to be made effectively as you just made them in closing. And this may make their case shaky.
But I think that it lends itself to the jury drawing conclusions that are speculative, and it lends itself to the jury really looking at propensity. Does she seem honest? Okay, she must have been telling the truth then, rather than actually, as we should be measuring this, do we have a satisfactory basis for evaluating the truth of the prior statement that she gave under optimal circumstances to the state?
You're here as amicus. Do you see the issue with the breadth of the rule that your colleague is suggesting? As you may have a witness, as Justice Pierre-Louis was talking about, who testifies about 99 counts and can't remember the 100th.
Do I see the issue?
Do you see the issue with?
I see that these are challenging questions that I'm endeavoring to answer as best I can.
I agree with you, they're challenging questions, but I don't recall. Suddenly undermines the admissibility of the entire statement.
Right. Well, if I may, think this is going to get me to the answer, but I am going to be slightly circuitous, if I may, which is that in Owens and in Sims, we have two situations of feigned lack of recollection, which I think is extremely different because I think what you're seeing there is almost, you don't get to commit an offense where you damage someone's memory physically in Owens, right? And then get the benefit of them not being able to remember, right? And that gets excluded. We almost have something close to forfeiture by wrongdoing there. And what we have here is a child who genuinely cannot remember. And I don't begrudge the child witness this, but we also have a scenario where the state has waited almost 3 years to even indict Mr. Harrell for reasons that have not been explained in the record. Almost 3 years. Knowing that we have this rule because children have fallible memories. There's no explanation for that. And then we have the state charging this as two offenses, but really as one act, these four incidents as one act, so that they can then get up here and say, well, she does remember some of it. And that can't give them an advantage. So what I am saying is that in this case, on these facts,
but we have no suggestion the state created the lack of memory.
There's no, I'm not suggesting that. No.
And I don't think either the confrontation clause or the evidence relies on the asks us to look at the promptness of the indictment or the way that the state chose to charge him. Those factors are nowhere in the analysis.
They're in the analysis insofar as, and I won't rehash this because it's in my brief, but in the fundamental fairness section of my brief, sometimes there is a due process problem when there is such a delay.
We're focused here for at least at this moment on the tender years exception and the confrontation clause.
Well, I raise these because the certified question that the court certified question began with the phrase under these circumstances. So while there can certainly be more far reaching implications here, under these circumstances, looking at these facts on this case, the fact that this child can only remember one incident and fails to remember 100% of three other incidents leads to or should lead to what the trial court did here. It doesn't mean they can't proceed on the under the table incident. We've all conceded that and they should be able to do so. However, when a witness fully forgets.
We have a constitutional issue here and you've laid it out very nicely in your presentation so far. I want you to speak to what you do in your brief, the recorded recollection hearsay exception. Does that survive constitutional scrutiny?
Okay. It may in certain circumstances and it may not. I think that there could be, in this circumstance, I do think that there is a confrontation issue with admitting this under a past recorded recollection.
Fair enough. We have a lot of advocacy to get through this morning, so I don't know that you need to go.
The only other thing I would say on that is that doesn't mean we should say, well, tomato, tomato, tender years, recorded recollection, because they do come in very different manners.
Well, we should understand the scope and breadth of the argument that's being made.
Yes. So I do agree that under this circumstance, we would submit that that admitting it as a recorded recollection would violate the confrontation clause. However, I think that there's still the issue that I've laid out or attempted to lay out as to why this doesn't pass muster under the tender years exception.
Counsel, we're just about at the 5-minute mark that you had for argument. So if there's anything else you want to raise,
briefly. Only other thing very briefly that I would add.
Take one more minute, please.
Thank you. I would just urge this court to, I want to draw this court's attention to Justice Albin's dissent in State v. Buddha, where he said, the right to a fair trial is transcendent, regardless of the nature of the crime or the age of the victim. Constitutional rights should not melt away when the accused is charged with a particularly vile crime, even when that crime is against a child. Evidence rules should not be placed in a state of suspended animation, even when a child victim evokes universal sympathy. The Sixth Amendment right to confrontation applies whether the accuser is 4 years old or 40 years old. And I would submit because the child here is unavailable to testify as to the core accusations regarding three of these four incidents, the correct conclusion would be to reinstate the ruling of the trial court and just redact the references to those three while leaving the other intact. Thank you.
Counsel. Mr. Leibowitz, we're going to go perhaps a little beyond 12:30. I know you asked for 20 minutes. Let's stop and hopefully complete your portion of the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The state respectfully requests that you affirm the appellate division's ruling because the admission of AR's unredacted tender year statement will not violate defendant's right to confrontation. My argument here today has two parts. First, the confrontation clause and what it requires, and second, defendant's arguments and why this court should reject them. Addressing the first part, it's undisputed that defendant has a right to confrontation and that it is important. However, it is not boundless. As the appellate division properly found, case law clearly establishes that a defendant's right to confrontation entitles him to an opportunity for effective cross-examination, not a cross-examination that is effective in whatever way defendant wants, to whatever extent defendant wants. Rather, a defendant's right to confrontation will be satisfied when the witness takes the stand, is placed under oath, and answers questions. That will occur in this case. AR, as evidenced by her 104 hearing testimony, will be present at trial. She will take the stand. She'll be placed under oath, and she will answer questions. Accordingly, defendant's right to confrontation would be satisfied, and that should end the inquiry. However, defendant nevertheless contends that his right to confrontation will be violated because she is a blank slate, because she has complete memory loss with respect to some of the allegations. Defendant's argument has four flaws. It mischaracterizes the record, it's contradicted by case law, it's based upon an attempt to improperly conflate the definition of unavailability under 804 and with the right to confrontation, and it will result in untenable consequences. As for the first part, AR does not have complete memory loss. She recalls a lot of this incident. It is only when we parse this as defendant seeks in a manner that is unsupported by case law that perhaps an argument can be made that she has no recollection. I would still dispute that based on the facts of this case, but again, that is based upon defendant's inappropriate parsing. Defendant's claim also must fail because the United States Supreme Court has found that a witness's poor memory does not have Sixth Amendment consequences. This finding has been adopted by seven circuits and 42 states, including our own in State v. Sims as recent as 2022. Thus, even if AR's testimony can be parsed in the manner that defendant seeks, she still would not be unavailable, as they assert. Defendant's right to confrontation still would be satisfied. Defendant's attempt to use the definition of unavailability under 804 is similarly unavailing and improper. Unavailability, defined under NJRE 804, is for the purpose of a party availing themselves of that hearsay exception rule. It doesn't apply carte blanche to everything else, and as your honors have pointed out, the state is proceeding under 803C27. Therefore, it is inappropriate to attach the definition in a subsequent rule unrelated to this to the case at bar. And then finally, as your honors have questioned, this rule the defendant seeks is untenable. It has untenable consequences, namely in that testimonial statements under 803C5 would be deemed unconstitutional, and that it's almost impossible to create a workable rule to determine when memory loss is sufficiently lost that it seemingly deprives defendant of the right to confrontation. It's for these reasons that defendant's interpretation cannot be correct, and therefore the state would ask that you affirm the appellate division's ruling. Unless your honors have anything that you'd like me to address, I can move into the remainder of my argument, but that is the end of my preliminary statement.
Stepping before we get to the constitutional argument, how common is the scenario that we're seeing here? A young child levels an allegation of sexual abuse and has a failure of recollection as time passes. How often do you see that?
Quite often, Your Honor. I think that is the purpose of 803C27, was a recognition that juveniles forget, that it is for very young victims under the age of 12 when they're disclosing. It takes years routinely for things to get to trial. So it is common that there are gaps of their memory that they cannot testify to. I can't give you a number, unfortunately.
With that in mind, following up on Ms. Heffron's argument, 3-year delay from an interview with the investigator until the time of indictment, why did that happen?
The investigation in this case took longer, especially when there was a second victim who ended up disclosing, and there was the addition of the official misconduct charges. I know that a lot of careful thought and deliberation is made dealing with juvenile victims who disclose regarding whether to put them through a trial, their wishes, things of that nature as well, the family's wishes and cooperation. As far as are there anything special or specific here, not that I'm aware of, that I can identify, but defense has never alleged a speedy trial violation. Defense has never alleged we've done anything in untoward. They have filed many motions. I understand the delay of this case at this point is, I believe, 8 years now. But there have been many filings in this matter. I'd also direct...
Assume there's no bad faith.
Yeah.
The lengthy time from the evidence first being presented until the time of indictment can exacerbate the very issue that is in front of the court today. Would you agree?
It could, yes.
And would be best avoided.
Ideally, yes, it would be best avoided. I would contend, though, that we don't know when she lost her recollection, so it is possible that a year after this was disclosed, she no longer recalls, 2 years. So while I understand that 3 years may trouble the court, there's nothing to demonstrate that is what caused it or would have been avoided had we brought it sooner. It may have, but I can't say that for certainty, and I submit it doesn't necessarily change the state's position with respect to the Confrontation Clause analysis here.
So address, if you would, the argument that counsel have advanced, that there's something unsettling about the notion that a witness takes the stand and cannot recollect any of the critical facts that go to the charge itself. Why is that not problematic?
Because that is what defense will elicit. That is compelling. As your honors have pointed out, many of you, this is effective cross-examination, showing that this witness does not recall this heinous allegation that they are alleging. I think that is telling. Defense can posit justifications, biases. Perhaps more importantly, no case has found that that's a violation of the Confrontation Clause. It's been routinely adopted that a witness's inability to recall has no Sixth Amendment consequence because the defendant can probe that and show that to the jurors.
And I take it your argument would be exactly the same if there were no table incident in this case. If all you had were the three, and tell me if I'm mistaken, the three episodes and the witness saying, I can't remember those episodes at all, you would still argue that the videotaped recorded statement could come in evidence, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. I think that Sims is telling. Sims is a very interesting, I guess you could call it, case study for our rules of evidence and the right to confrontation. In Sims, the victim was shot, provides a statement to his, I believe it was grandmother, then provides a statement to police. When it comes time for a Wade Henderson hearing, he completely backs up and says, I do not recall. While that may be a feigned lack of recollection, that's a finding that the court makes, but the jurors don't know that. They make the determination, is it feigned or not, and how they should evaluate that. But notably, at the time of trial, he doesn't testify at all. And therefore, he's unavailable, and that's why 804 was done. And once peeling back that layer, this court found, despite his repeated, I don't remembers, I can't recall, an inability to really testify and provide anything of substance at that Wade Henderson hearing, the defendant's right to confrontation was still not violated, that he had a meaningful opportunity for cross-examination at that hearing, and that is why the state was ultimately permitted to use it in Sims at trial, even though he didn't even testify. That is a situation in which the victim, much like ours here, said, I do not recall. And this court found that was still an opportunity for effective cross-examination. And it quoted Owens and Green. In every case, essentially, that we've had that has recognized that an inability not to recall does not have Sixth Amendment consequence.
You agree, despite the fact that the defense may have a compelling cross-examination based on the failure to recollect, that the state will have an incredibly compelling piece of evidence when the video is shown and three incidents that are completely untested and unable to be challenged in any way, shape, or form are presented along with the one that's challenged both presently and described in the past.
While it is a strong piece of evidence, I can assure you the state would love it for the victim to be able to testify in front of the jurors so that they could hear from her. So defense can't allege that she's somehow making it up as evidenced by her inability to recall. The state wants nothing more than for her to be able to testify and is equally prejudiced as defendant is by her inability to do so because it is our burden to prove it. Defendant just needs to poke holes in it. And while I understand it's ultimately the defendant who faces the consequences of the actions, it's the state that must prove the charges and wants this evidence too. This is a secondary piece that we will, of course, seek to use and want to use because it is reliable evidence as deemed by the trial court. The defendant never appealed or challenged that ruling, and the jury should be able to hear it. So, yes, Your Honor, to answer your question, it is a strong piece of evidence for the state, but I would disagree with any assertion that defense won't be able to properly cross-examine the witness on this and set forth an effective cross-examination as Justice Patterson had asked with many questions. It's going to be quite compelling, and I do not envy the trial prosecutor who's going to have to present this to the jury. I did provide the court with a quite lengthy string cite in preparation for today. I did realize, unfortunately, that three of the cases in the first portion that were supposed to only be tender year statements were erroneously included in there. Hawaii v. Santos is actually an excited utterance case. Maine v. Adams is a recorded recollection case. And Bush v. Wyoming is a statement to a psychologist. Nevertheless, they still support the state's proposition, and had they not been in the first part, would have been in the second part of that long string cite, as states that have recognized a witness's inability to recall has no Sixth Amendment consequence. And I believe nearly every one of those cases, Owens or Green, is cited for this proposition because every court, has recognized there is no issue.
There's no case that ever come out the other way that you found, correct?
I think there were several on the back end of my site that were slightly distinguishable, and I think one state did. I'm not sure how they addressed it going forward, as there weren't subsequent cases analyzing that, and it seemed very fact specific. But for the most part, no. As to your Honor's question regarding a constitutional line and the empty vessel, I submit that defense asked this court to find that AR is an empty vessel after they've dumped out the water that was in it. She recalls this one statement. As Justice Pierre-Louis has pointed out, if a witness is on the stand and testifies about 99 things and forgets one of them, that doesn't suddenly make them unavailable. You need to evaluate that person's memory as a whole. And I submit that that's not what's being asked of this court here. She recalls it. She recalls one instance with specificity. This is a continuing course of conduct. If you look at her actual statement, it's not as though she's providing specific dates. Ultimately, I would contend that none of that matters because a lack of recall in and of itself is insufficient. But if this court does look to create some kind of ruling regarding how much forgetfulness is too much, I would like to point out that it should view the witness as a whole and not in the parsing manner that defendant wants, that I would submit unsupported by the law. Just commenting upon some questions that were earlier raised, Justice Noriega, you had mentioned closings. I submit that that is a great opportunity for defense to argue what they want and to frame why this is going to be so successful for purposes of cross-examination. They will have an opportunity for effective cross-examination. Leaf, I've already addressed Chief Justice's constitutional line question. Justice Patterson, I agree that this is effective cross-examination, not merely an opportunity for effective, but all that is required is an opportunity for effective cross-examination. The cases defendant relies upon are all distinguishable. In Coder, the witness didn't testify at trial. In Nyhammer, the witness was silent and unresponsive. Nothing is like the facts here. In this case, AR is forgetful. A witness whose testimony is marred by forgetfulness does not have Sixth Amendment consequences. And thus, the state would ask that you affirm the appellate division's ruling and find that if AR comes to court, testifies, takes the oath, that defendant will be afforded his right to confrontation, and the admission of AR's unredacted tender year statement does not violate his right to confrontation.
Questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Carosha, how much time do you anticipate using?
Maybe like 5 minutes.
Requesting you're going to be a person of honor, just as Mr. Leibowitz was, coming in under his time.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The Attorney General's interest in this case is ensuring that established and fairly decided law on two doctrines, the Confrontation Clause and the Tender Years Clause, the Tender Years Rule, remains unaffected by the facts here, which run no risk of violating either of them. Admission of AR's statement would be proper and fair because defendant will receive an opportunity for effective cross-examination, and her imperfect memory on individual incidents does not make her unavailable to testify under the tender years rule. There are things that AR does remember about these incidents. She remembers, generally speaking, about, you know, incidents with the Detective Rios. She remembers showing on the doll where she had been touched. She remembers that she was trying to tell the truth at the interview. So while she does not recall the three incidents of touching that we've already discussed, she does recall surrounding facts more than just what the classroom looked like and things like that. There are more, these types of things are aspects on which she can be cross-examined as well that we haven't mentioned so far. First, with regard to tender years, as Justice Wiener after noted, the witness simply has to testify. The witness is not subject to Rule 804, which is not, this, you know, specifically not subject to 804, which is why State versus Coder is inapplicable. In Coder, there was an inability or unwillingness to testify at the 104 hearing, and then she was not called at trial. That witness did not remember seeing defendant, talking to the police, didn't know why she was in court, whether areas on her body shouldn't be touched, whether anything that happened, you know, to make her feel sad. Here, that is completely contrary to what AR will testify to. At the 104, she answered all questions on direct. She answered all questions on cross. The judge even made a finding that she possesses the ability to recollect and recall and relate. There is no tender years issue in terms of her availability in this case because she will testify. Now, with regard to the confrontation clause, the case law tells us that so long as AR appears at trial, one, two, takes the oath, and three, answers questions willingly, the confrontation clause is satisfied. That's exactly what will happen here. Under Owens, so long as there is a full and fair opportunity to probe against forgetfulness, confusion, evasion, lack of care, bad memory, that is sufficient for constitutional purposes. The weapons available, as said in Owens, will not always achieve success, but success is not the constitutional guarantee. With regard to Nyhammer and Sims, Nyhammer, again, similar to Coder, there was a case where, you know, the witness was completely silent and unresponsive, which is, as I've noted.
Counsel, if you view Coder and this case as being part of a spectrum of circumstances, where is the constitutional line drawn? You know, well, obviously, Coder, the child was just shaking her head, as I recall those facts.
For purposes of the constitutional line, do you mean in terms of what a response would be?
What is the point at which the witness's ability to provide evidence resolves the constitutional issue? Does the witness have to do in order to provide a sufficient opportunity for cross-examination?
It is when the witness answers a question willingly, verbally. So here, for example, AR, there's no evidence in any of the transcripts that AR either nodded or shook her head or anything like that. Whereas in Coder, as Your Honor mentioned, that's what was going on there to the extent that she even answered questions at all. So that to me would be the difference.
Even if their answers by themselves could not establish a conviction.
Can you rephrase the question, please?
If you didn't have this videotape, could the state obtain a conviction on the three incidents?
With just her getting on the stand and saying, I don't know, I don't remember, it goes to her credibility in front of the jury. So if
you wouldn't be able to establish the elements without the tape, no, you wouldn't have any evidence short of her testimony, which would be, I don't recall anything about those three incidents. Could you get a conviction on the three incidents under those circumstances?
Well, it would be an issue in terms of evidentiary issues, but it wouldn't be a constitutional issue.
Could you get by a Rule 29 motion?
I would suppose that it would, if it gets to trial, I would suppose that it would depend on the facts of that case.
I don't think this is a hard question. If no witness takes the stand and says, these incidents took place, and the only proof of that is on a videotape that doesn't come in evidence, can you get a conviction?
Correct, no. Because there's no evidence in evidence to show the jury.
Did that worry anyone?
No, because the purpose of tender years is to make sure that statements like these are preserved, because we know of the faulty memory of, you know, certain child victims, which has been spoken about in this court, which led to the tender years rule adoption. So I don't think that should trouble the court here.
Preserving them makes sense, but using them at the trial, knowing that the victim doesn't recollect the incidents at all, even speaking to the detective about it, isn't that a different analysis that the state should make?
But she does remember in this case, though. She remembers not exactly the touchings themselves, but she remembers the circumstances surrounding them.
But I thought that the testimony was that at the hearing that she specifically did not recall those three incidents. She didn't recall the incidents happening. She didn't recall even speaking to the detective about them. She didn't, like, watching the video, she says, I don't remember saying that, you know, and she remembers the fourth one. We all know that that one's isolated. But those other three, they're not, she doesn't remember anything about them, even like happening. She remembers being in the classroom, details surrounding it, meaning she was in school at the time, but not the incidents themselves in any way, shape, or form. Shouldn't that be troubling to the state to present those aspects of the case's evidence?
But she does testify. If you look on page 36 of the transcript, she does testify, says to the officer that she did remember some of the statement, and she did remember speaking to, I think she calls him Detective Joshua,
Well, of course, if she remembers the last incident, then she would remember the rest of the statement that she gave to the officer as far as that. But as far as the three, just isolating the three, she does not recall giving those particular statements to the officer.
Correct.
She remembers the doll.
Yes.
Right. She says she remembers touching the doll or being told to touch the doll at the places where she had been touched, right?
Yes.
And those were only for the other three because the table incident, as it has been termed, would not have involved touching of her in any way. So it would not have involved the doll, correct?
Right. Is this the sort of thing that's happening a lot? A witness gives a statement under the 10 years exception, and then years later, a trial on the stand says, I just don't remember.
Well, I'm not sure if it's happening under the 10 years rule super frequently, but I do know that it was part of the reason why the 10 years rule was enacted. So it is definitely a concern under the 10 years rule. So the only other thing I wanted to sort of talk about was Sims. And Sims, as well as State versus Cabell, both of those cases are feigned lack of recollection cases. But both of them are underpinned by Owens and Green. Both of them cite to Owens and Green. And so it's the Attorney General's position that the fact that there's a feigned lack of recollection versus a perceived real lack of recollection is also of no Sixth Amendment consequence. Because the confrontation right depends on defendant's opportunity to probe AR's lack of memory, feigned or not. And if the court has no further questions, the Attorney General would ask the court to affirm the decision of the appellate.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you to all counsel for the very helpful arguments. We're going to take